welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, let's start today with the conversation that you and I were having a few weeks ago about California and how the spread of COVID-19 there has not played out exactly according to expectations, or at least to some of the projections. And the theme that you've been sounding about this virus pretty much from the start has been about intellectual humility, about being cognizant of what we know and what we don't know. But in the aftermath of our conversation and some of the writing that you've been doing on this topic, especially as regards California, you were accused, including by some media outlets, of doing precisely the opposite. Walk us through what happened here.
Well, I wrote an article in NRO, and I thought it was pretty balanced. I didn't make any claims whatsoever that I knew what. I just said California has about half the deaths per million as Germany, which is held out as a model, and it has twice the population of New York, and it's got about a tenth the number of cases and about a twelfth the number of deaths. And so why is that true? And I mentioned Texas was doing well, and I said, here's all the different reasons that people have adduced: the weather, it's warmer, or the data's bad, or the data's late, or Gavin Newsom went on March 19th with a total shutdown, or it's coming, just wait, or the virus was here more earlier than perhaps patient zero, I think that was in January 20th in Washington. Then I went back and I said, this shouldn't have been happening because we had 5,000 to 7,000 Chinese, the most in the country, arriving all of November, December, January, and then into February via connecting flights in Europe. And that was an aggregate over 1 million people, 3,000 a day, the mayor of New York, Los Angeles had bragged. So then I said, well, you know, we're no hotter than the South, and the data, no state has been accused of having bad data, really, and Newsom was only 3 days earlier in the lockdown than most states that followed him within 3 days, like New York. So maybe it is that we had some immunity, and that would mean that the virus either swept through California in early January or even in the late part of 2019. And then I said that Stanford researchers all were investigating that in the sense that they were planning antibody tests in samples, I think, of 1,000 or 1,500. And that's what I said. I said, but we have to be a little bit humble, and this is a mystery. The next thing I knew, a station in Monterey implied that I was a doctor running tests. And then the next thing I knew, local media got a hold of it. And then the next thing I knew, it was all over left-wing media that I was kind of a denialist. And the next thing I knew, a woman in Slate, Jane Hu, said that I was a racist for suggesting that it was caused by Chinese visitation. The next thing I knew, some people wrote to the Hoover, they wrote to Stanford, they even wrote to the Alumni Association, and they tried to silence me, and they got very angry, and then I had to write a clarification, and I wrote another one, and it didn't stop, and I wrote another one. And I guess what I'm saying is that there was a lot of confusion. I used maybe improperly the word herd immunity, but what I meant was that whatever the number is of previously infected or whenever they were infected, it's going to change our whole perception of the virus, because if it's analogous to 15%, as the German study showed of a typical community, or the Roseland Hospital in Chicago that did random antibody, or the 200 pregnant women who came in and tested positive at 15%, then in a state like California, you can see that you're getting up to 6 million people, and that could explain the slowdown. But even if you took a worst case scenario, like the Finland 1 or 2%, and you said, well, only 1 or 2% or maybe 3% of California, well, that's a vast number. That would be 400, 800, 1.6 million. Now, why is that important? Because we're using, for the first time in my memory in an epidemic, an exact number as the denominator, the case number, which we know is false. We know that the people who feel sick or who feel exposed go in and get tested, and those who are the minority that test positive, then that represents on all these crazy internet meters and all these modeling, that's the number who have the virus. And then you divide that into the number of dead, and you get this 3.5%, 4% death rate per 100, and 3 or 4 deaths per 100. Everybody goes ballistic. But even if it's only 1 or 2 or 3, and you start dividing in a state like California, 400, 800, 1.6 million, 1.2 million into 800 or 900 dead, then you can see what happens. It starts to resemble, if not be less lethal than the flu. And if it's less lethal than the flu, then when Gavin Newsom said on March 19th that his model showed 25 million would be infected, and given the lethality rate that day, I think it was 3%, that could be over a million dead, unless you listen to Gavin Newsom and shut the state down. Well, I realize that by just suggesting that without being a participant and having no medical credentials, then I was written off, and I wrote a book with the title Case of Trump as a partisan that was trying to warp the debate so that we would get back to work. And it's I guess, characteristic of this climate that we're in the age of the internet, social media, Trump's running for president, it's an election year, there's Chinese mysteries, put them all together in perfect storm fashion. And every single thing a person writes is now weaponized, whether, you know, think about it for a minute, Troy. I mean, make a statement about hydroxychloroquine, that's now a political statement. If you think it has some efficacy, right, then you're a pro-Trump supporter. Mention the word flu in context of the corona, then you're a Trump supporter. Mention that you think it's highly irregular that the lab was so close to the patient zero in Wuhan, and it was probably connected with the SARS epidemic. Not that you ever believed, I don't believe that at all, that there was a manufactured virus, but I think there's this lot of news accounts coming out in the last 48 hours that it might have escaped, and then you're a Trump supporter. And that's too bad, because what happens, this internet pack goes after you, and they never go after you by, as I wrote to one person who keeps writing to other people at Stanford, he wrote another group letter to administrators at Stanford today in anger. But my point is that they never just confront you. They always go to your editor, or they go to your boss, or they go to your place of employment and say, how dare you? How could you? And I try never to do that. I mean, when the woman wrote something about the writer at Slate, I thought was smearing and really contemptuous, saying that I was a racist for suggesting that visitation was responsible for the outbreak, which it was. I mean, I didn't accuse her of being racist because she denied the obvious and she was of Chinese apparent ancestry. But my point is, I would never go to Slate and say, how can you print this person? But that's how the left seems to operate. And they got to be very careful.
I want to pick up on something that you referenced there a moment ago. So there have been an awful lot of pronouncements over the past few months made with imperious certainty that have subsequently proven not to be true, whether it's public officials telling people to go about their lives as normal, the total about-face on face masks, et cetera. But it now looks as though we might be on the cusp of the biggest one yet. As you mentioned, so this is not confirmed yet, but there are now reports from outlets as disparate as the Washington Post and Fox News to suggest that the origin of COVID-19 may have been in that Chinese laboratory, not as a bioweapon, but because of lax safety protocols in studying the viruses there. And when the first utterances of something like that hit the air a while back, there was a big pile-on about it being conspiracy theory. So this may turn out to be false, but it has clearly passed the point of being implausible. If this turns out to be the case, I mean, the only analogy I can think of is that this is communist China's Chernobyl, but obviously on a much bigger scale. What would be the appropriate reckoning for China?
It's a very good question, and you're right. People were, Tom Cotton was smeared, but right. If you read that article in The Diplomat yesterday, I called one of the sources for it, who's a Chinese fluent native speaker and works for the U.S. government, and he confirmed it, that it was accurate, he felt. And what the story said was maybe they were experimenting and they were way over their head as far as the lethality of these coronaviruses versus their ability to control them. And one got out and then they dallied and lied because of this trade war they were in with us, and they didn't want to lose market share, and they thought they control it, and then it just, they couldn't control it. They couldn't control finally even the World Health Organization, although they tried. And then somebody just threw up their hands and said, you know what, if we're going to go down, don't tell the U.S., don't tell Europe, shut down Wuhan, make sure no flights go out of China into Shanghai or Peking, but let them go into the U.S. That's kind of where we are at now. If that happens to be true, that's kind of an act of war. And yet, China is a 1.4 billion person, second largest economy, nuclear power. So what do we do? And it's easy to say we disconnect. We all want to do that. But the problem is that when you look at these STEM disciplines in science and math and engineering and technology, our higher education has been dependent on foreign students and foreign residents, and we don't have the muscle, brain muscle power, the experience, are enough people to remain competitive yet. So I think what we need to do is right now bring, obviously, pharmaceuticals, medical supplies, rare earth metals, military applied technology back. And then we've got to get into sort of a Sputnik reaction where we really try to recalibrate these universities. And why in the world would we have a diversity and inclusion czar when we don't have a science and math czar? And so that's what we need to do. And as far as China, we're going to have to, I think we're going to have to bulk up our alliances with Taiwan, which was a model in this crisis, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and look to form something like the old SATO that wasn't very successful, but maybe something like an Asian NATO. We're going to have to really push after the North Korea, the missile defense, especially along the West Coast and at sea. And I think we're going to have to realize that this is not the first time it happened, and it's not going to be the last time it happens. And they've hit on, maybe accidentally, but they've hit on something that's far more lethal than a nuclear bomb. It's sort of a neutron bomb we all remember from the 1980s. It can destroy the United States economy without harming its infrastructure.
In your most recent syndicated column, you argued that we're coming near an inflection point with COVID-19, that the status quo, such as it is right now, can't hold. This is a complicated set of decisions that have to be made. Take me through what you think the decision points there should be and how the president and the various governors and mayors should be thinking about them.
Well, the president's at the cusp. He's going to have to make a lose-lose decision, and that means if he dallies beyond May 1st, we're getting 20 million unemployed plus, and we're probably going to lose 20 or 30% of GDP in this 30-day shutdown that was slowing down before that because people were anxious. And if he doesn't get us back to work, then we're in trouble. I mean, if he doesn't get us back to work and create the confidence that people feel it's like the flu, and they can handle that, and therefore they go to restaurants, cruises, as we talked about. They have to be able to feel, I mean, the government can't make them go to a restaurant or a theater or a cruise or take a flight, take the bus. They have to be wanting to do that because they're not afraid. And Trump then has to create the conditions under which they're not afraid. And what would those be? Well, we're reaching some inflection point on a multiplicity of such decisions. One of them is antibody testing. We're either going to find out that the case number, the denominator, is accurate of the known tested positives, or it's 5 times too small, 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. But whatever it is, it will affect the lethality rate. People will be terrified at 3 people per 100. They won't be terrified at 1 per 1,000. And so we're going to watch that. Some people are going to be discredited. Some people are going to be confirmed in their suspicions. We'll see. We also want to know what happens if you get it. So when we go back to work, Trump can say, you know, what do you have to lose? Try hydroxychloroquine. Everybody said, how dare the AMA said that's, but there's a lot of double-blind studies, and it'll either have some efficacy for people who started early, maybe not on ventilators, or won't, and we'll find out that. A lot of people said, you know, the common cold is a coronavirus, and it peters out in the winter. So does the flu. Maybe some coronaviruses don't. But if you look at a map of where this infection is the most dense, it seems to be less severe in around the equator or maybe in Africa or Latin America. And that means that maybe over degree 90 or 85 degrees, the virus doesn't do too well on surfaces or in the air, as most viruses don't. And people get outdoors or not concentrated, so we're going to get a natural boost. We're going to find out that's accurate or that's dumb. And we're going to find out because we're getting into the late spring and we're going to get in May and summer. And parts of the United States are getting up. I mean, we almost got up to 85 the other day here in California. So we're going to learn that as well. And so I think we're reaching an area where a lot of these scientific questions, the modeling is going to be resolved, and that's going to affect the decision and how people feel. And then Trump is going to sort of make a gamble and hope that this comatose patient can be resurrected, you know, with paddles and not go back to sleep. We'll see.
I want to close with reference to another piece that you had recently at National Review about the way forward, what the return to normal looks like, especially on the economic side. And this is what you said there. The choice is ours, whether America awakens as a roaring giant or a crying baby. What do you mean by that?
Let's go the crying baby. So we kind of sort of gradually go back to work. And then let's say New Orleans finds out that a lot of people decide, you know what, we're back at work and we're going to go party in bars, Mardi Gras light, and they get a hot spot. And then the New York Times runs pictures of seven people on the front page and said, Donald Trump killed these people. And then there's a hysteria. Or then people decide, you know what, I've got my 401k back at 60 or 70%. I've got a pension. I'm not going to go out. I kind of like doing nothing. I'm just going to stay home. I'm not going to go on a flight. And the economy just kind of goes back and kind of sort of doesn't. And then meanwhile, Adam Schiff says, ah, this is going to do what Robert Mueller and my impeachment didn't. And he starts holding impeachment hearings on Trump's statements that it's comparable to the flu, even though Nancy Pelosi said, you know, come to Chinatown 3 weeks after his travel ban. So if we have that reaction, or we have the Michael Bloomberg reaction, hey, hands off China, you guys, you're racist, or you shouldn't do this, let's just go back to business, then we're in bad trouble. If we have a Pearl Harbor day after reaction, when we get a bipartisan task force that says, what realistically can we do now to get essential industries as back as quickly as possible without harming their availability or without China cutting them off while we're trying to do it? And then how do we restructure our universities to become competitive in these outsourced industries? And then let's run the election on the issues and not go back and run, you know, each side run these tapes of who was more naive about the virus. We'll be okay. I'm not very optimistic, as you can tell by the tone of my voice.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll have more cause for optimism next week, Victor, and that will be when the next episode is available. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, all of Victor's work can be found at victorhanson.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.